Asia-Pacific currents.
News and labour issues from the Asia-Pacific region.
We strongly condemn the police that arrest the protesters.
Saturday mornings at 9 o'clock.
On Community Radio 3CR.
Workers of the world should unite to fight this greedy capitalist.
Brought to you by Australia-Asia Worker Links. Good morning and welcome to another episode of Asia Pacific Currents here on Community Radio 3CR. It is 2 minutes past 9 o'clock. I'm Giselle Hanna.
I'm James Barry.
I'm Kieran Bennett.
And we're taking you through to 9:30 this morning. Of course, thank you to Annie McLaughlin for another wonderful Solidarity Breakfast show this morning. And of course, Asia Pacific Currents is brought to you by Australia Asia Worker Links. You can find us on the web, all the www.aawl.org.au. We're on Facebook and Substack. Look us up on those social media platforms. In the second part of the show, we're going to be speaking with our resident Iran expert. Who's that, James? Who's James Barry is our resident Iran expert. I mean, folks, most of you have probably felt the war in your pockets in relation to the cost of the squeeze on fuel and the consequential cost of living crises that are emerging because of that. I know that most of us leftists have a bigger vested interest in ending the war in relation to humanity and all of those factors. It has made headlines for other reasons, though. We'll be talking about that in the second part of the show, but I think we'll go straight into news from around the region.
Yes, heading into the news, let's talk about Nepal, where we see an appalling ban on public sector unions. The cabinet of Nepal's newly elected Prime Minister, Bhalan Shah, has approved the abolition of trade unions within state bodies as part of measures they claim to depoliticize government institutions. This decision would leave workers in public health, sanitation, water, energy, local government, and welfare services without the right to union protection. Labour organisations around the world issued announcements this week condemning the moves by the Nepalese government. Global Union Federations, which organises workers across the Asia Pacific, issued a joint statement alongside union partners declaring that such a move would directly violate Nepal's constitution, breach international agreements, and of course undermine the democratic right of workers to organise and bargain collectively. They called on the Nepalese government to withdraw unconditionally its proposal to ban trade unions in the public sector and to engage in genuine social dialogue with trade unions on any proposed reforms to labour relations. In addition to the union ban, the government has also decided to remove student unions from campuses and replace them with non-partisan student councils within 90 days.
To the Philippines now. On Wednesday, community health workers in the Philippines, known as barangay health workers, celebrated a major organising win, securing their first union registration with the Department of Labour and Employment. The newly registered Maka BHW Pilipinas Union, which represents first responders who deliver health services to remote impoverished villages, announced that its goals are focused on building worker power and improving health services across the country. Like many of their comrades in Nepal, India and other parts of the Asia-Pacific region, the barangay health workers in the Philippines have lacked recognition as public health workers and are deprived of fair wages and decent work. The registration of the union follows on from another victory last month when the Filipino Senate approved the proposed Magna Carta of the barangay health workers, which seeks to guarantee a minimum monthly honorarium of US dollars, as well as benefits to help with transportation, workplace hazards and insurance coverages. There are an estimated 250,000 barangay health workers across the Philippines, mostly female, and they often put their own health at risk in times of crisis, such as the COVID pandemic more recently, for the benefit of public health.
And moving now to the Middle East, the announcement of a ceasefire in the Middle East this week was followed by the deadliest day of the war in Lebanon, with more than 300 people killed in Israeli attacks across the country. Iran called it a violation of the ceasefire, since despite initial denials by Israel and the United States, the first point of the agreement was to end hostilities in all countries, with Lebanon specifically named. The World Federation of Trade Unions issued a statement declaring the attack a dangerous escalation of Israeli aggression against Lebanon, which is aimed at a longer-term occupation which will further destabilize the region. By Thursday evening, following an international outcry, Israel has said it had agreed to enter negotiations with Lebanon, but the attacks continued.
And heading for slightly better news in South Korea, where May Day is now a public holiday. The South Korean government has officially designated May 1 as a public holiday. Along with Constitution Day and now Labor Day, the number of statutory holidays has increased to 17. The Ministry of Personnel Management and the Ministry of Employment and Labor announced on Monday that a proclamation bill for an amendment to the Act on Holidays containing these provisions was approved by Cabinet. With Labor Day designated as a holiday, civil servants, teachers, and specially employed workers such as courier drivers will also be able to take May 1 off. Until now, they were not classified as workers under the Labor Standards Act and had to go to work on that day. The government plans to hold a commemorative event in line with the holiday designation of Labor Day. The Ministry of Employment and Labor has said the day will serve as an opportunity to renew social awareness of the value and dignity of labor.
To India now, where ambulance workers in the northern Indian state of Himachal Pradesh will be returning to work tomorrow, ending a five-day strike in which they demanded that that basic labour laws and court orders relating to their work be respected. Hundreds of workers, who are divided into two groups, 102 ambulance workers that provide free transport for pregnant women and infants, and 108 ambulance workers who are emergency ambulance workers, they gathered to protest in front of the state secretariat in the provincial capital, Shimla. The action, which was organised by the Centre of Indian Trade Unions, focused on how, despite court rulings, the workers are still not being paid the government-declared minimum wage and are forced to work 12-hour shifts daily with no overtime and are frequently denied their leave entitlements. In many cases, the employer's share of Social Security insurance payments is instead deducted from the worker's own salary, cheating them of about 5% of their income per month. Union leaders report being stood down, bullied, or moved on if they raise concerns. The union stated that the strike is not just about money, but about the right to be treated as more than just a pair of hands. The workers are demanding their entitlements with arrears.
And our last story this morning, unfortunately, is the next chapter in Hong Kong's diminishing of trade unions in that part of the world. Hong Kong's Registry of Trade Unions recently gazetted that the Hong Kong Professional Teachers Union had been officially dissolved as of 23rd of March. The dissolution of the teachers union not only marks the demise of a 50-year-old institution, but it also stands as a grim milestone in the rapid evaporation of Hong Kong civil society. Only five new unions were registered in 2025, a 12-year low that signals a near total paralysis in grassroots organising. This decline represents a staggering reversal of the union boom seen in 2021, when the city boasted a record 1,527 registered bodies. In the years since, nearly 10% of these organisations have vanished. The exodus was precipitated by the 2020 National Security Law, which triggered what many describe as a political cleansing of independent labour groups. While union advocates contest the legality of the banning of unions, the most vocal activists have ended up in prison. It's 9 minutes past 9 o'clock here on Community Radio 3CR. You're listening to Asia Pacific Currents. We're going to go to some community announcements and then our feature interview with James Barry after those announcements.
You're listening to 3CR 855 AM, the voice of the community.
3CR, community radio, giving the voice to the community since 1976.
The state Labor government has begun works on demolishing Melbourne's 44 public housing towers to be replaced with private housing. Already hundreds of residents have been displaced, often into unsuitable homes under duress.
The towers on Racecourse Road, Flemington, have become Homes Victoria work sites, while the families still living in the buildings are being treated appallingly.
Join Save Public Housing supporters in solidarity with residents.
Weekdays 7:30 till 9 a.m. as we engage with passing traffic to make some noise and show Jacinta Allen
that the demolition of public housing is unacceptable. Signs and banners provided or bring your own.
There's power in numbers, so see you at 120 Racecourse Road, Flemington, 7:30 till 9 a.m.
Save Public Housing is a 3CR supporter.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. 3CR is determined to stay independent. This means we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We serve our community, not corporate interests. But this also means we do rely on people like you to keep the station running. From paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, 3CR relies on community donations to survive. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
It's 9:11 here on Community Radio 3CR. Well, as I said at the top of the show, our feature interview this morning is with resident Iran specialist James Barry. It's been a couple of weeks since we've really kind of looked into and analysed the situation. Of course, you know, what was meant to be a quick in-and-out war like Venezuela has persisted some, I think we're in 12 weeks. Is this the 12th week of the war?
No, 6 weeks.
6 weeks? Yep. Oh, just hyperbole. You never went astray in left-wing politics. Let me ask you, in the last week, a ceasefire has been announced. Let's just get some facts on the table. What's the basis of the ceasefire?
So Pakistan brokered a ceasefire at the last minute. As many listeners would know, every Saturday when the markets are closed, Trump would threaten to attack Iran over the last couple of weeks, would threaten to escalate. They're already attacking Iran, obviously. And every Monday or Tuesday, he would then back down before his deadline. And I guess he was betting on the market. This last weekend, he threatened to wipe out Iranian civilization. By 8 a.m., I think, or 8 p.m. Monday, US Eastern Time. And just before that happened, Pakistan announced that they'd brokered a ceasefire deal between Iran and the US, accepting as a basis of negotiation, a 10-point plan by the Iranians. Now, that 10-point plan had a number of interesting things in it. One of the interesting things is, of course, that the document that was in Persian was different from the document that was in English, slightly different. But it included such things as recognizing Iran's sovereignty or right to charge for the use of the Strait of Hormuz, which has been a key area where the US has been shown to be quite weak in being able to fight Iran. Lifting of all sanctions, the US withdrawal from the Middle East. Of course, Iran is surrounded by US bases. That's a big issue for them. An end to all attacks on Iran and its allies, including Lebanon. And a UN, the release of frozen assets and a UN Council resolution that would make it binding, because one of the things that Iran has said is, how do we know we're not going to be attacked again when we're negotiating? Because this attack happened by the US side to being fruitful negotiations. Now, they're an interesting bunch of points, because obviously, you would expect the US is not going to accept most of them in their current form. But also, I mean, the US put forward a 15-point plan at the end of last month, which was also like ridiculous in terms of like saying to Iran. More, one of the key points, or several of the key points, was that there was going to be no defense mechanisms at all. Like, Iran should get rid of its ballistic missile programs, its interceptors, and everything. Which, of course, no country would ever accept that if they were able to. The difference between the Persian and the English language points that were shared by the Iranian government was that the Persian language document said that Iran should be allowed to pursue nuclear enrichment to its to its heart's content, which, you know, the, even though the US has not been very clear on why they're actually fighting the war, and I think that, like you said, they thought it would be quick, easy and out, in and out like Venezuela, which I don't know why, who was advising them that that would be the case there, but that's what they thought. One of the key points that keeps coming up is Iran's nuclear program. Just on Iran's nuclear program, the US and Israel and others believe that Iran is making a weapon. Well, they're enriching it because they are enriching at quite high levels. Iran has always said that they want to use it for civilian purposes. That probably isn't just the case, but it is. They do make an argument because they have tried to get nuclear power as a way of diversifying their energy sources. But so there's, you know, a bit of everyone's telling lies and everyone's telling a bit of truth in that case.
I think the imperialist interests, though, are very clear. I think if the US was able to achieve control of the Strait of Hormuz, that would have been incredibly beneficial from an imperialist perspective. And I think what we're witnessing is the cost of not being able, well, the cost of the US not being able to control it, not that I'm in favour of the US controlling the Strait of Hormuz. But the other part of it too, what I think is less being discussed, obviously the war in Lebanon is being discussed, but it's not really being described in the mainstream press as an ethnic cleansing, a genocide of the south of Lebanon, encroaching further into that territory. Talk to me a little bit about what that front is, what it's about. Why?
So on an official level, in terms of officially what the media is saying, the justification for Israel invading Lebanon is because Hezbollah, joined, as a proxy of Iran, started attacking when Israel started attacking Iran. But Israel, by Israel I mean the Israeli government and the Israeli media, have made a number of statements about what they actually their long-term goals in Lebanon are, which is an occupation of the south of Lebanon, possibly for the expansion of territory that they could use in settlements. The Litani River, which cuts across the south of Lebanon, is primarily where they've talked about the area they want to occupy. The Israeli government has been floating this as a permanent occupation, saying that officially that it would be about a buffer zone. For those who who've been following Israeli, Palestinian, Lebanese history for a while would know that Israel, they occupied the south of Lebanon for about 20 years. In Israel, it was called Israel's Vietnam because it was a complete failure of an occupation. But now in Israeli newspapers, there is talk about, and this happened in 2024 when there was another war with Hezbollah in Lebanon, they're talking about occupying the land and settling it. So the Israelis have seen settlements as both an area of expanding their power, but also a way of dealing with the high cost of living within Israel itself. They've been using the West Bank settlements as a means of having cheaper land for people, and it looks like they want to do the same in Lebanon. 1.1 million people have been displaced in this process. That is maybe a quarter or more of Lebanon's population. And there's a lot of, Lebanon's a small country. I've been there. There's not much place to move around. It's when you move 1.1 million people, it's going to have a much more tremendous effect. It's already getting, 1.1 million people, when you think about it, it is already a huge number of people. But in an area as small as that, it's profound, the damage it's done. Overall, that's the long-term goal. And in Israel itself, there's complete support for this war. Their media is tightly controlled anyway. Anything that goes wrong is blamed on a non-existent left. And the real goal for the Prime Minister of Israel is to stay out of jail. He wants perpetual war. He wanted to have that in Gaza. He couldn't have that in Gaza. So he's going to create a perpetual war elsewhere, and that probably is going to be in Lebanon for the time being.
It strikes me that a ceasefire then wouldn't exactly be in the interests of the Israeli Prime Minister. And what we've seen over the last couple of days, is that an attempt to perpetuate the perpetual war? If there is some kind of durable peace, what does this mean for Israel's war ambitions?
So with the Israelis or with Netanyahu and his group, one of the problems is if they do stop the war, then he has to deal with his other cabinet members who are always telling him, no, we want a war, and we'll break from the cabinet, we'll break from the government if you don't. So what they tend to do is say that there's a ceasefire, and then just continue attacking. That's usually it. This time they haven't not even said there's a ceasefire. They said, oh, we're not party to the ceasefire, but we're going to negotiate with the Lebanese government. But then they're continuing to attack. Like we saw a day after the ceasefire was announced, the deadliest day in Lebanon in this current conflict. And it was just hitting apartment buildings and hitting health centers and just like horrible stuff. So their idea is just to see, to push Trump and his short attention span, take advantage of his short attention span as long as they can. Of course, Iran doesn't want that at all. And Iran has threatened to break the ceasefire if it's not adhered to. So yeah, the Israelis just say, well, we're not party to it. It's an American-Iranian agreement. And but we'll negotiate with the Lebanese. But then they just keep attacking. So they want to keep, that's how they're trying to find ways just to perpetuate it, keep it going.
I did want to ask you, because you talked about Israelis being completely on board with their government in this time. But we are seeing suppressed media, I appreciate, but still some attempt at resistance in Israel, some mass protests in the streets opposing the war, opposing the government. What do you say about that?
So that group of people who are protesting, they're quickly being silenced. I know there were protests in Tel Aviv that were, I think they were arrested for protesting. I guess the overwhelming support argument for in Israel is based on polling that's been done recently on supporting the war, which was like more than 80%. I think for the Israeli Jewish population, which is 80% of the population, is like 90% support the war. And the rhetoric is that, oh, Iran is a nuclear threat to Israel, so this war is about Iran. So when it's put to Israelis like that, then that's fine. But it is also putting a stress on in their lives. No one's sleeping in their beds at the moment because they're having to go to shelters every night because of the missiles. The head of the military said that the pressure on reservists and the pressure on the army is so great that they're not able to achieve their goals. So it isn't just a simple case of that, yeah, of course, they completely support every aspect of the war. But when it's put to Israelis that, oh, this is about getting rid of the Iranian threat, and Iran has been a boogeyman for Israelis for a long, long time, past 20, 30 years, then that's the reason why they say, oh, yeah, we're totally on board for that.
I think we're quickly coming to the end of the time that we've got, but I did want to, while we're talking about internal dissent, thought it was worth talking about where things are internally in Iran, though it is under immense military pressure at the moment. There were significant people's uprisings at the end of last year, seemingly all suppressed, or it's just not the time to be fighting your government when your government's being fought by imperialism. What do you say about where the internal movement of dissent is at in Iran and what that means for the stability of the Iranian government at these times?
It's impossible to know because we can't contact people in Iran. The internet is shut off. Their communications are shut off. But even if we could, you wouldn't easily get a clear picture of that. What I would suspect, and this is one of these sort of common themes that is accepted as what you would expect in Iran, is that when Iran is under attack, the ability for those who are opposed to the government to succeed is much less, because as you see in other countries as well, people can hate their government, but they hate a foreign government invading them more. And you don't win people over by bombing them. So even if it doesn't mean that they love the Islamic Republic of Iran, but they're not going to love Israel or the United States bombing them more. So, it's not going to necessarily bolster support for the regime, but it's definitely going to make the regime more militarized and therefore making it harder for an uprising to be effective.
And just by way of closing remarks, what do you say about the prospects of negotiations at this point and any possibility of ending the war?
It's hard to tell because there's so much volatility. Obviously, we've seen the American red line is having oil prices and energy prices going up. They're not willing to keep fighting for that. They say that they've achieved their goals, that there's a regime change in Iran, which is, they've installed a monarchy, which is the Khamenei monarchy. It's hard to tell. The Iranians are going to push to have further control of the Straits of Hormuz. You'd assume that they'd all negotiate down, But in some ways, it looks like Iran has done quite well. If Iran is able to get sanctions relief or something out of this, even though they don't necessarily have much security, it's going to be better for them. The United States has also exhausted itself a little bit militarily, and that doesn't bode well for other conflicts that may oppose, may appear in the coming years, such as in the Pacific.
I guess that leaves it, folks, incumbent upon us as the left to build what seems impossible to build right now, an international mass movement in opposition to global warfare. Kieran, prospects of success on that question?
Well, it's socialism or barbarism, as always, and the challenge is definitely before us.
That does bring us to the end of another episode of Asia Pacific Currents here on Community Radio 3CR. James, thanks for sharing all of those insights.
Thank you.
Coming up next is Palestine Remembered, but please stay tuned to 3CR for the rest of the weekend. Continue to support Community Radio. We're going to go out with a song, and coming up next is Palestine Remembered. But for now, that's it from me, Giselle Hannah.
Me, James Barry.
Me, Karen Bennett.